hook on. Thanks, bro.
Thanks, bro.
But the coffee too hot, make it more la lengua. Pity the fool now. When it's too hot, you gotta learn to cool down.
Homeboy, I came to party.
Party.
Don't you keep wasting my energy.
Don't do it.
She's a haggler. No, I'm not tagging this. Me impressing the white Jeep. I'm my passenger. What you trying to do? What you wanna do? What you trying to do? What you wanna do?
Puerto Rican party pop buying a bar.
Can I get this? Is the doctor.
Yo, this is Slim Kid.
This is Fat Lip.
This is Imani. This is the Far Side. That's who we are. Yo, check it out. We just chilling. You know what I'm saying? Yo, Imani, what station are we on? CKUT
90.3
FM. Cooler.
This is Democracy Now!
The Democrats' principal failure in election after election that they should have landslided prevails today. They don't know how to talk to blue-collar workers.
With the midterm elections 2 weeks away, we speak with former Green Party presidential candidate Ralph Nader. He's warning Democrats may lose control of the House and Senate by failing to connect to voters on the economy and other key issues. We'll also speak with Mark Green, the former public advocate of New York City. Then we look at China as Xi Jinping begins a historic third term as head of the Chinese Communist Party.
In the face of new challenges and tests on the new journey, we must be highly vigilant. Always maintain the sobriety and prudence to catch up with the examinations and promote the strict governance of the party across the board without ceasing, so that the century-old party will continue to flourish in its self-revolution and always become the most reliable and strongest backbone of the Chinese people.
We'll look at what 5 more years of Xi Jinping means for China and U.S. China relations. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In the United Kingdom, Rishi Sunak has been sworn in as prime minister, succeeding fellow Conservative Party member Liz Truss, who resigned her post after just 6 weeks on the job. Sunak was a supporter of Brexit, Britain's narrowly approved 2016 referendum on whether to exit the European Union. He comes from one of the nation's wealthiest families, with a net worth estimated at more than $800 million. He was the wealthiest member of the House of Commons. Sunak becomes Britain's first-ever prime minister of color and third prime minister in 50 days after Boris Johnson resigned amidst a series of scandals. Rishi Sunak delivered his first address as prime minister from 10 Downing Street earlier today.
I will place economic stability and confidence at the heart of this government's agenda. This will mean difficult decisions to come.
Rishi Sunak was a Goldman Sachs banker. Across the UK, calls are growing for a general election. The leader of Scotland's National Party, Nicola Sturgeon, said Monday the turmoil in the Conservative or Tory party showed the need for greater Scottish independence.
It's going to be the fifth prime minister in the years that I've been first minister. Now, I'm only saying that to illustrate the instability and the uncertainty and the chaos that the Tories have unleashed on all of us. They have no mandate. And, you know, it is a democratic necessity that people get their say on who occupies number 10 Downing Street.
Representatives from Ethiopia's government and rebel forces in Tigray gathered in South Africa Monday for peace talks mediated by the African Union. The talks came as the United Nations warned the situation in Ethiopia is spiraling out of control, with reports of widespread atrocities, including airstrikes and artillery fire that have exacerbated a humanitarian catastrophe. Some estimates put the number of dead in Tigray at 800,000 since fighting erupted less than 2 years ago. The UN says the resulting health crisis now threatens 6 million people. The UN's International Atomic Energy Agency says it will send inspectors to two Ukrainian nuclear sites after Russia claimed, without evidence, that Ukraine was preparing to deploy a radioactive device known as a dirty bomb against Russia. Ukraine has rejected the charge and plans to bring up the issue at the UN Security Council when it meets today. Meanwhile, Germany's president has arrived in Kyiv on his first visit to Ukraine since Russia invaded in February. President Frank-Walter Steinmeier's trip comes 2 days after Germany's ministers of defense and foreign affairs called for a dramatic boost in German and European Union aid to Ukraine's military. Here in the United States, a group of 30 progressive Congress members is calling on President Biden to pursue direct negotiations with Russia. In a letter sent Monday to President Biden, the 30 lawmakers, led by Congressional Progressive Caucus Chair Pramila Jayapal, write, quote, "We urge you to pair the military and economic support the United States has provided to Ukraine with a proactive diplomatic push, redoubling efforts to seek a realistic framework for a ceasefire," unquote. The letter goes on to state, "The alternative to diplomacy is protracted war, with both its attendant certainties and catastrophic and unknowable risks," unquote. A Russian court's hearing an appeal today by WNBA basketball star Brittany Griner, sentenced in August to 9 years in a Russian penal colony after she pleaded guilty to carrying a small amount of marijuana oil into Russia. A ruling is expected later Tuesday. Griner was arrested at the Moscow airport in February when customs officials found vape cartridges containing a small amount of cannabis oil in her luggage. In Missouri, a teenage gunman shot and killed a teacher and student at the Central Visual and Performing Arts High School in South St. Louis on Monday. Four other students were shot and wounded before the gunman was shot dead by police. Police identified him as a 19-year-old recent graduate of the school. He was armed with a long gun and more than a dozen 30-round magazines. Witnesses say many more people could have died if the gunman's gun had not jammed during the assault.
I was trying to run, and I couldn't run. Me and him made eye contact, and I'm glad I made it out because his gun got jammed. But we saw blood on the floor. I think somebody got shot.
In Michigan, a teenage gunman pleaded guilty on Monday to charges of first-degree murder and terrorism for a mass shooting at Oxford High School in a Detroit suburb last November. Ethan Crumbly was just 15 years old at the time of the attack, which killed four students and injured six other people. Crumbly may be called to testify against his parents, James and Jennifer Crumbly, who face manslaughter charges for allegedly giving the gun used in the shooting to their son as an early Christmas present, and for failing to intervene when their son showed clear signs of mental distress ahead of the massacre. In Florida, Republican Governor Ron DeSantis faced off against Democratic challenger Charlie Crist Monday for their first and only debate ahead of November's election. DeSantis refused to say whether he would serve a full 4-year term if reelected in November, adding to speculation he'll compete for the Republican Party's presidential nomination. Meanwhile, Charlie Crist blasted DeSantis over his anti-scientific views on gender, climate change, and the COVID-19 pandemic.
Ron, I wouldn't pat yourself on the back too much about your response to COVID. We've lost 82,000 of our fellow Floridians. And when you look at the Thanksgiving table, one of those empty seats is probably one of those people for many families watching tonight. And if we had only had the standard of other states in the United States, 40,000 of those people would still be alive, enough to fill Tropicana Stadium in St. Petersburg. That's tragic.
Charlie Crist served a 4-year term as governor of Florida, beginning in 2007, when he was elected on the Republican ticket. He later switched party affiliations to become a Democrat. In Pennsylvania, Democrat John Fetterman and Republican Mehmet Oz are set to meet this evening for their first and only debate. We'll get the latest on the U.S. midterm elections later in the broadcast. The Supreme Court has put a temporary hold on a judge's order that would require South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham to appear before a Georgia grand jury to answer questions about his efforts to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election. On Monday, Justice Clarence Thomas granted Senator Graham's emergency request to put the subpoena on hold temporarily while Graham's lawyers pushed to have it quashed permanently. Democrats have demanded Justice Thomas recuse himself from cases related to the 2020 election because his wife, Ginny Thomas, spread false claims about a stolen election and lobbied federal and state officials to overturn the election results. Supreme Court rules obligate justices to withdraw themselves from cases where there's even the appearance of a conflict of interest. In Minnesota, former Minneapolis police officer J. Alexander King accepted a deal Monday that will see him plead guilty to aiding and abetting second-degree manslaughter in the killing of George Floyd in May 2020. In exchange, state prosecutors agreed to drop a murder charge against King, who faces a likely 42-month prison term at a future sentencing hearing. On Monday, another former officer, Tu Tao, waived his right to have a jury decide his fate and will instead have a judge weigh existing evidence against him in a stipulated bench trial. Tao and King are already serving federal prison terms after they were convicted of depriving George Floyd of his constitutional rights. In the West Bank, at least six Palestinians were killed and nearly two dozen others injured following raids by Israeli forces early Tuesday morning. Al Jazeera reports one of the victims, Qusay al-Tamimi, was 19 years old and lived in the village of Nabi Saleh near the city of Ramallah. In related news, Amnesty International is calling on the International Criminal Court to investigate possible war crimes committed by Israel during its latest deadly assault on the Gaza Strip in August. Among those killed by Israeli forces were a four-year-old child and a teenager who was visiting her mother's grave, according to a new Amnesty report published Tuesday. Agnes Kayamard, Amnesty International Secretary General, said in a statement, quote, "Israel's latest offensive on Gaza lasted only 3 days, but that was ample time to unleash fresh trauma and destruction on the besieged population. The three deadly attacks we examined must be investigated as war crimes. All victims of unlawful attacks and their families deserve justice and reparations," Kayamard said. In Iran, over 300 people have been indicted on criminal charges for participating in the massive protests that have rocked the streets of Tehran and other cities in Iran for more than a month. At least four of them were charged as enemies of God, an offense that can carry the death penalty, according to Iranian officials. Despite the brutal crackdown, demonstrations continue in Tehran, sparked by the September 16th death of 22-year-old Mahsa Amini while in custody of the so-called morality police. On Monday, Iranian security forces fired tear gas at a girls' high school. A clash between school staff and students reportedly broke out after the school's principal insisted on checking the students' cell phones. In Bangladesh, at least 16 people are dead and some 10 million left without power after a cyclone triggered torrential rains, heavy winds, and flooding in the capital, Dhaka, and across other parts of the country. Cyclone Sitrang made landfall in the coastal regions of southern and southwestern Bangladesh late Monday, destroying homes and cutting off telecommunication lines. About a million people were evacuated. This comes as scientists warn climate change is likely making cyclones more intense and frequent. North and South Korea exchange warning shots in waters off the west coast of the Korean Peninsula Monday after South Korea's military accused a North Korean merchant vessel of crossing a maritime boundary. The exchange of artillery fire came after South Korean forces joined the USS Ronald Reagan carrier battle group for U.S.-led war games of the Korean Peninsula. It follows a record pace of weapons tests carried out by North Korea this year. On Monday, South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol promised a strong military response to what he said were plans by North Korea to carry out its first nuclear weapons test in more than 5 years.
Not only has it openly announced its intention to preemptively use nuclear weapons, it appears that preparations for a seventh nuclear test have already been completed. We will strengthen our deterrence against North Korea with overwhelming capabilities through the combined defense posture of South Korea and the United States, as well as security cooperation between South Korea, the United States, and Japan, so that our people can live their daily lives with confidence.
Back in the United States, public health experts are warning cases of respiratory syncytial virus, or RSV, are skyrocketing among children, overwhelming hospitals nationwide as many are near or at capacity. RSV starts with mild cold symptoms, can lead to pneumonia and bronchiolitis, and very young children can be life-threatening in infants and young adults. And Penn State University canceled a speaking event Monday night with Gavin McGinnis, founder of the far-right group The Proud Boys, following massive backlash and student-led protests. The event was sponsored by the right-wing student organization Uncensored America and also featured right-wing Blaze TV host Alex Stein. Penn State officials accused peaceful protesters of obstruction and censorship, but then claimed to not support McGinnis and Stein's views. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. When we come back, we look at China as Xi Jinping begins a historic third term as head of the Chinese Communist Party. We'll look at what five more years of Xi means for China and U.S.-China relations. Valley Stream by Chinese-American composer Zhou Long. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show looking at China, where Xi Jinping has begun a historic third term as head of the Chinese Communist Party. The decision came over the weekend during the party's Congress, which is held every 5 years. There was also a major shakeup of the seven-member Politburo Standing Committee, which is China's most powerful governing body. China's premier, Li Keqiang, longtime rival to Xi, was demoted while four Xi loyalists were promoted. The party's top official in Shanghai, Li Qiang, appears set to become China's new premier. He's a close ally of Xi. He oversaw the harsh COVID crackdown in Shanghai that lasted months. Perhaps the most dramatic moment of the Chinese Communist Party's Congress came when former President Hu Jintao was abruptly escorted out of the closing ceremony. He'd been sitting right next to Xi Jinping when two men came to escort him from his seat. Some analysts speculated the move was an assertion of Xi's dominance. Chinese state media later said it was because the former leader was not feeling well. We turn now to look more closely at the future of China as Xi Jinping begins a third term. Under Xi, China's continued decades-long effort to eradicate extreme poverty. Some 800 million people have been lifted out of poverty over the past four decades in what U.N. Secretary General Antonio Guterres has called, quote, the greatest anti-poverty achievement in history. But Xi has also overseen a growing surveillance state to silence dissent and target ethnic minorities, including the Uyghurs. And Xi's third term comes at a time of growing tension between between the U.S. and China over Taiwan and other issues. We go now to two guests. Yacho Wang is senior China researcher at Human Rights Watch. She's in New York. And in Baltimore, Maryland, we're joined by Ho-Fung Hung, professor of political economy and sociology at Johns Hopkins University. His books include Clash of Empires, From Chimerica to the New Cold War and the China Boom, Why China Will Not Rule the World. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Thanks so much for joining us. Professor Ho-Fung Hung, let's begin with you. Talk about the significance of what happened this weekend. Talk about who Xi Jinping is and how his policies have changed over the years.
My pleasure to be here. Thank you. And what happened over the weekend is very significant in the sense that though we actually expect it to come for a while, because in 2018, Xi Jinping managed to abolish the two five-year term limit of the Chinese president. That is kind of a term limit that Deng Xiaoping led to impose in the Chinese constitution in the 1980s, because after the Cultural Revolution, Deng and the Communist Party leader think that it is not good to have lifelong leader. It is good to have check and balance within the party. And Xi Jinping managed to take away this term limit so that, not like his predecessors, Hu Jintao and Jiang Zemin, that who each served five terms time as president of China, Xi can now theoretically serve unlimited term, that until he died, and he can be a lifelong leader of China. So this kind of abolition of the term limit as a legacy of the Deng Xiaoping era is significant. So it was done in 2018, but people didn't believe that other party elite will let him actually do it to have the third five-year term. But he managed to do it. It just proven over the weekend that he managed to do it. Not only that, but also he managed to put all of his own loyalists, absolute loyalists, in the Politburo Standing Committee. So the people from other factions, for example, some people who tip to be in the Politburo Standing Committee or the Politburo who belong to the Hu Jintao, the previous president faction, were not there. It seems that in the next 5 years, at least, Xi Jinping is established his own absolute personal control of everything in China without much check and balance within the party.
And talk about what happened this weekend. Do you think that was deliberately staged to remove the former leader sitting next to Xi Jinping as a message that he was consolidating his power? Or, in fact, do you think it is what China said, what the government said, that he wasn't feeling well?
Definitely that in this kind of a carefully choreographed rituals of the Communist Party, it is unimaginable. There's this kind of accident or incident that is totally out of nowhere. And of course, there is a possibility that he actually feel unwell. But now more video footage emerged from the Spanish and the Singaporean TV showing what happened before he was former President Hu Jintao was escorted away from the Congress. It didn't seem like he is unwell at all. That it appear in those video footage that he tried to open a folder with some documents, and Li Jianshu, who is sitting next to him, tried to prevent him from looking at the document and seize the folder. And then Xi Jinping called somebody to come and take him away. And initially, he appeared to be reluctant to leave, and then the guards and the person behind Hu Jintao seems to be using some kind of force to take him away, and then he eventually left the Congress reluctantly. And then after he decided to leave, and he walked quite fast, and then he can walk on his own, and it didn't seem to me that he's actually really feeling unwell, and I don't think it is the real reason that he left. And then why Xi Jinping called somebody to escort him or even nearly forcefully take him away from the Congress, that I think Xi Jinping move is carefully considered and calculated to show that he can do whatever he wants, and he can even take out a former president from the Congress in front of the camera. And of course, that people are speculating that I think it is reasonable to suppose so that Hu Jintao might not be very happy about the so-called election result of the Politburo and the Politburo Standing Committee without any of his loyalists there. Xi Jinping might worry that he might give a face or a lot raising hands or a lot clapping hands in the final section. So it is a possibility that Xi Jinping deliberately asked somebody to take him out to prevent this embarrassment.
Yaqiao Wang of Human Rights Watch, your response to what has taken place and the significance of Xi Jinping beginning this historic third term?
Well, I think, we expect this to happen because in 2018, the term limit for the president was limited. But it was still a very depressing moment because it became a fact. You know, I talked to friends and families back in China. People were depressed because in the past 10 years since Xi came to power, the horrendous human rights violations Xi Jinping committed was just striking. And now he's going to have another 5 years, at least. So I think people are expecting things can go worse. So people were quite depressed. But at the same time, you know, people now are very angry with the zero COVID policy. People are, you know, protesting in China with a guy, you know, in Beijing held a, posted a banner on a bridge and people were responding to that. So I, on the one hand, I see people are unhappy, depressed. On the other hand, I see people are waking up and they wanted to, you know, say, I want freedom. I want human rights. I want to, you know, to decide how I'm governed by my government.
Professor Ho Feng Hung, Xi's human rights record, what that means, and your assessment of his rule and the effect he's had on the Chinese people, and your response to the UN Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, talking about this, what he called, monumental taking on largest anti-poverty program in history.
Yeah, definitely that Xi Jinping, like his predecessor Hu Jintao, is a kind of a brutal repressor of human rights. And it's not that human rights violations started in Xi Jinping. Actually, in the Jiang Zemin era, in the Hu Jintao era, we already see a lot of crackdown in the Han majority area and also the Lan Han minority regions. But Xi Jinping but just raised it to the new level, as we now very much aware of what happened to the Uyghurs in Xinjiang. It is happening under Xi Jinping watch. So in terms of the repression of human rights, the Communist Party, whether it is collective leadership or it is one-man dictatorship, it has been pretty much the same. And what Xi Jinping brought in something new compared to the Hu Jintao and Jiang Zemin era is that he even cracked down brutally on his allies, his other elite within the Communist Party, because after Xi Jinping became the president, he launched its anti-corruption campaign. And then many elite, even senior officials and private business people disappear or mysteriously commit suicide or taken to jail under the name of anti-corruption campaign. And many people will see that it is not exactly an anti-corruption campaign. It is more like a purge. In China nowadays, not only dissidents and minorities are afraid, but also some elite and middle class, and also Xi Jinping doubled down on expanding the state sectors, state companies, and making private companies and foreign companies' life more difficult in making money in China and keeping their wealth and jeopardizing their private property as well. In the next 5 years, at the very least, that this kind of draconian policy that I called some kind of a law of Koreanization of China's politics and the economy is going to double down and is going to get worse.
And Yacho Wang, the significance of Li Keqiang, a longtime rival to Xi, he's demoted, while his loyalist, Li Chang, looks like he's about to be China's new premier. You mentioned the crackdown in Shanghai, but talk about the significance of the COVID crackdown, what it actually felt and looked like in this massive city.
Well, I mean, it lasted from April to June for 2 months that, you know, a city of 20 million people are confined to their homes. And as a result, you know, people had huge difficulties to have food delivered to them and to access to hospitals. And I've heard stories from people whose parent has a heart attack or other emergency, and they couldn't leave their apartment complex, or even they managed to leave their apartment complex. They couldn't actually get into the hospital. So there are people who died as a result of the lack of access to hospital facilities. So, and then there are the people who were, they had no food. And then there are the people who lost their jobs and they couldn't pay to get food delivered. So the human rights violations associated with this draconian lockdown was massive. And then, you know, it ended. And the people say, you know, Li Qiang, the party secretary of Shanghai, is ultimately responsible for this. Now this guy was promoted. So you can see, you know, Xi is rewarding people who are loyal to his policy rather than rewarding people who are good for the public.
Professor Ho Feng Hung, I mean, relations with China are, if not in an all-time low, extremely bad right now. And I'm wondering if you can comment on what is taking place. In one of the pieces you wrote, you said the dynamics of U.S.-China rivalry is an inter-imperial rivalry driven by inter-capitalist competition. Competition for the world market could soon turn into intensifying clashes of spheres of influence, and even war. So you're not talking about the difference of ideologies. In fact, you're talking about a similar capitalist ideology.
Yes, indeed. That I myself is not quite supportive of the framing of the U.S.-China rivalry as a Liu Cold War. It is a catchphrase used a lot of time nowadays, indicating that the difference between China and U.S. is fundamentally ideological and political. I think, of course, that this difference is real. It's very true. There's a large difference, but it is not the necessary and sufficient conditions that lead to this rivalry between the U.S. and China today. Because right after the 1989 massacre, human rights is already a huge concern about China in the discussion in the U.S., and many people already very unhappy about what is going on in China with regard to human rights and Tibet, Xinjiang. It is all its old problem that in the 1990s, U.S.-China relations get more and more harmonious regardless of this human rights difference and political system difference. What is different now in comparison to the 1990s and 2000s is that back in the 1990s and 2000s, transnational corporation, American corporation, they are very happy making money in China. They have a good time in China, and so they don't care about the human rights, they don't care about labor rights, they don't care about all kind of political difference between U.S. and China. But so far as they are making big money, they are finding it very profitable in China, so they lobby the U.S. government, the U.S. Congress, to have a more amicable and harmonious relation with China whenever there is concern about labor right, human right violation in China, in the Congress. They will lobby against those bills in the 1990s and 2000s. So the U.S. corporations have been kind of ambassadors of the Chinese government to soften U.S. policy on China, even though geopolitically and in terms of human rights, political system and ideology, there's already a vast difference. What happened after around 2010 is that China economy started to lose steam. The economic pie no longer expand that fast. And then the market share in the U.S. corporation market share in China start to stagnate or even decline. because the Chinese government is helping the Chinese state enterprise and Chinese private enterprise to expand the market share in China and around the world in the Belt and Road country at the expense of U.S. corporations. So it is a turning point that U.S. corporations rarely individually voice their concern about this business environment in China. Of course, there's also other problems like intellectual property theft and unfair competition and unfair enforcement of regulations, so on and so forth. They don't voice this concern individually, but in the survey, the anonymous survey conducted by, for example, the American Chamber of Commerce in China and U.S.-China Business Council and all these kind of business association in the U.S. all show that the American business in China situation is deteriorating. They are looking for diversifying their investment, and they no longer eager to lobby in the names of Chinese interests. So it is why the geopolitical difference between U.S. and China, the human rights and political difference between U.S. and China can now prevail and influence largely the direction of U.S.-China policy. So fundamentally, it is a kind of a intercapitalist competition between U.S. corporation and China corporation in the Chinese market and in the Belt and Road and other developing countries' market that lead to this deterioration of U.S.-China relation.
I wanted to go to the flashpoint, Taiwan. During his opening address at the Communist Party Congress, Xi Jinping lauded his government's response to the COVID-19 pandemic, addressed the economy, China's military and foreign policy. He also praised Beijing's crackdown on Hong Kong, claiming Hong Kong shifted from chaos to governance. President Xi also addressed the issue of Taiwan, which has become this flashpoint between China and the U.S.
The resolution of the Taiwan issue is a matter for the Chinese ourselves to decide. We insist on striving for the prospect of peaceful reunification with the greatest sincerity and with the greatest effort. However, we are not committed to abandoning the use of force, and we reserve the option of taking all necessary measures.
Yacho Wang, your response.
Well, I think, you know, yes, I think it's obvious that there's more aggressive rhetoric coming from the Chinese government on the Taiwan issue. And I know people in Taiwan are nervous. But at the same time, I see, you know, people in Taiwan are, they are very protective of the freedom, of the human rights they have. And they organize themselves together, and they wanted to retain that freedom. They're alert of the situation, and they are active in, you know, pushing back the kind of pressure coming from China. And also, I'm saying that, you know, governments around the world, including the U.S. government, also, you know, doing more to support the vibrant democracy in Taiwan. So, yes, China has become more aggressive. They're more hostile rhetoric. But at the same time, I think I also see more pushback from Taiwan and the democracies around the world.
Professor Hofeng, Yang, your response.
Yes, actually, I think there are two sides of the question. On the one hand, China is closer toward using military force to forcefully take Taiwan. On the one hand, because the zero COVID policy and many things it did, that Beijing did over Hong Kong, show that it is no longer a regime that prioritizes economic growth and economic prosperity, and they prioritize national security and control, absolute control of the Communist Party, even when it comes to sacrificing the economy, they will do it. So on that regard, that Beijing has less restraint when it decide to attack Taiwan. But on the other hand, I think the immediate military threat is not there yet, because you look at, for example, Russia military action against invasion against Ukraine. There's a path from the Russian foreign intervention and overseas military deployment in Georgia in 2008, Syria, and also the Ukraine in 2014. So this dictator logic is that they tried smaller scale intervention. If they succeed, they get more confident, and then full scale invasion. And you look at China, if the leadership is still rational, they will look back to their military history. They will find that the last time China fought a war overseas was 1979 against Vietnam. And the last time China actually have a serious military mobilization of its military, of this army, is 1989, which is against its own people. China has not actually used the military against any overseas target for decades. So I don't think it will easily jump from zero to an all-out invasion of Taiwan. But I think that Beijing might try to talk up the military rhetoric, the threat, and also might even do some limited military action to take some outlying islands of Taiwan or some South China Sea Taiwan now controlled by the Taiwan government as a kind of a threat or even a partial blockade of Taiwan to create a kind of a tense situation to influence Taiwan election, to influence what the Taiwan people might want to elect for. If Beijing managed to get some of its allies or even its agent elected in Taiwan through election, then that the pro-Beijing government can sign agreement with Beijing and do a lot of things that U.S. cannot find a reason to intervene or to deter. But I'm confident that the Taiwan people is very clear what is going on, and they have a will and they have the capacity to defend their vibrant democracy, which is a kind of a miracle. And it is why the Beijing find that Taiwan is a thorn on its back, because it is an affluent Chinese democracy and liberal society, which is very vibrant. And it show that actually democracy can work in Chinese society, that actually contradict Beijing's propaganda that actually democracy is not suitable for Chinese people. I'm confident that the Taiwan people will have the will and capacity and alertness to defend itself.
Ho-Fung Hung, we want to thank you for being with us, sociology professor at Johns Hopkins University. And thank you so much to Yacho Wang of Human Rights Watch. When we come back, midterms are less than 2 weeks away. Democrats are facing tight races. We'll speak with former Green Party presidential candidate Ralph Nader and author Mark Green about their project Winning America and their new report Crushing the GOP 2022. Stay with us in 30 seconds. Chicago. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. With midterm elections in the United States 2 weeks away, Democrats are facing tight races, even in places like New York State, where they've been the dominant party for two decades. New York's Democratic Governor Kathy Hochul has a single-digit lead over her Republican challenger, Lee Zeldin, a Trump acolyte, the two of their first and only debate tonight. Meanwhile, Democratic Congressmember Sean Patrick Maloney of New York, chair of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, and a five-term incumbent, is facing a stiff challenge, his race now considered a toss-up by analysts. Nationwide, 35 Senate races are up for grabs. Republican-held Senate seats targeted by Democrats are extremely close in Wisconsin and Pennsylvania, where Democratic Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman faces Republican Mehmet Oz in their first and only debate tonight. For more, we're joined by two guests who write about this and so much more in their new report titled Crushing the GOP 2022. Mark Green, political organizer, author, Ralph Nader, legendary consumer advocate, corporate critic, four-time presidential candidate, Ralph Nader. Together, they formed a project called Winning America. As the Washington Post noted in a recent profile of Ralph Nader, for the first time in his 88 years, Ralph Nader's campaigning for the Democrats, not against them. Ralph Nader is the author of many books, including Breaking Through Power, It's Easier Than We Think. And Mark Green just wrote an op-ed for the New York Daily News headlined, Democrats Closing Pitch, the party needs to sharpen its message now. We welcome both to Democracy Now! Ralph Nader, let's begin with you. As you join us on the phone from your home in Connecticut, talk about what you feel the Democrats are doing wrong right now.
Well, what they've got to do is authenticate their message and their rhetoric where people live, work, and raise their families, often called kitchen table issues. And they've got to compare and contrast life under the authoritarian, bigoted, corporate indentured GOP with life under the Democrats. For example, 20, 25 million people will get a raise to $15 minimum wage under the Democrats. The GOP is against that. The assault on children by the GOP is absolutely stunning, from not using available Medicaid funds to insure them, to exposing them to hazardous pesticides, and denying paid family leave and sick leave. The GOP is against that. The $300 a month child tax credit to 58 million children in our country, cutting poverty, child poverty by a third, was suspended because of GOP opposition in January. And it continues. Voters will be more repressed under the GOP. Precinct workers will be more intimidated under the GOP. They're trying to steal the election while they accuse the Democrats of stealing the 2020 election. In area after area, the Democrats are not rebutting and taking the offensive, which is what politics is all about in an electoral campaign. The GOP is the party of anxiety, fear, and dread. You can document that from A to Z, and they're not being adequately rebutted. Midnight campaigning, over 25 million workers work the midnight shift. They're ignored by candidates. What the candidates now in Pennsylvania, Ohio, Florida, Texas have got to do is campaign all night for all the workers who keep the country going while we're asleep, and recognize them, respect them. They're hospital workers, nursing home, police, fire, emergency people, people working the midnight shift in factories. So this report, winningamerica.net, you can get the whole report, is full of the best presentations by 24 civic leaders and advocates who know how to talk to people. They don't stratify people left, right, conservative, liberal, when they advance their causes. All of this is presented to the Democratic candidates and the Democratic Party free. The question is whether they will break through their political and media consultant force field, which keeps them from having input from civic groups, and find all the ways that are very poll-tested, by the way, that will grab the attention of liberal and conservative voters alike. A lot of the issues are boiled down in this report under a two-page card, in effect. Your choice in 2022, compare the Democrats and GOP, and the GOP is against every one of these, whether it's minimum wage, strengthening gun safety laws, taxing the wealthiest firms and the super rich, guaranteeing freedom and equality for women, ending the dark money and campaigns, providing Medicare for all, raising frozen Social Security benefits, restoring voter rights, funding child care and sick leave, fighting climate violence with renewable energy, reducing skyrocketing drug prices, and increasing funding to prosecute corporate crooks. All of those are opposed by the GOP. So politics is a practice in contrast, and the Democrats have got to get with it and learn how to communicate, especially with millions of blue-collar workers who have deserted the Democratic Party and broken the FDR coalition that won so many elections.
It seems
winningamerica.net.
It seems, Ralph, that Democrats are in some cases more afraid of being called socialists than they are afraid of Republicans. Can you respond to that?
Yeah, well, that's why they've got to learn how to rebut, and it's not too late in the next 2 weeks to do that. When they're accused of being socialists, there are three rebuttals. One, oh, you Republicans are against socialism. I know why you're saying that, because you hate Medicare. You hate the post office. You hate Medicaid. You hate public drinking water departments. You hate public schools. You hate Social Security. That's why you're talking socialism. But you are really corporate socialists. You want to bail out every corporation of any size. You want to subsidize, hand out all kinds of stuff to corporations in a mockery of your so-called free market philosophy. The same with defunding the police. The The Republicans are defunding the corporate crime police. And let me tell you, when you're talking about death, injury, and disease, corporate crime towers over street crime. Just think of the opiates and the almost 1 million Americans who've died from the criminal promotion of the opiates throughout the country. And these corporate crooks got away with it. You get a 90% poll on prosecuting corporate crooks and increasing the corporate crime enforcement budget. And the same at the street level. The Democrats are for community policing. They want safer guns. They don't want that many guns on the streets. The Republicans are on the other side on that. This report, winningamerica.net, is full of the best thoughts of these civic leaders who have helped change America, but have been excluded by the political media consultants surrounding these Democratic candidates because they want the 15% commission on TV ads, and they don't know a ground game from anything. They're not interested in a ground game to get the vote out and to get more voter registration because they don't get a commission on that.
Well, Mark Green, you have run for office. You're a keen observer of all these races around the country right now, as one after another is now being called, a toss-up. What do you think the Democrats are failing to do, and particularly talk about the focus on Donald Trump?
Well, thank you, Amy, and thank you, Ralph. Ralph just, as he has throughout his entire public life, been comprehensive about how the Republicans are blocking Democrats from delivering on their wallets and their rights. That would be a great starting point at the beginning of a midterm election that ultimately is about democracy versus fascism. But now, in the last 2 weeks, you got to know how to be rhetorically muscular against a party, the Republicans, who don't hesitate to call Democrats not only socialists, but communists and murderers. And so, at this point, Democrats can't flinch at being blunt and reducing their campaigns to one, two, or three major phrases and concepts. Because, like it or not, five-second voters, regrettably, have responded to these loaded phrases, woke, cancel, grooming. Democrats have better policies. How the hell are they losing to a party with apparently better messages? And so Biden, who's been a very good president and wanted to be and has been a uniter, has to rise to the occasion. Not only the civic and public interest groups that Ralph is talking about in our report, But the public hears, because the White House has a big decibel count, when the president says it, then others follow. So there are three topic sentences, basically. The overall is that the GOP are dangerous extremists who are stealing our freedoms and our wallets. What does that mean? One, Social Security. Public understands that. You don't have to spend a lot of money and time. They want to have annual budgets rather than mandatory funding for Social Security, which means they're going to cut Social Security to you who've been paying in for your entire work life. Second, they're the party of violence and corruption. It's not just January 6th, which they explain away, but their refusal to have adequate gun laws, so we have far more gun murders leading to higher crime, and their assaults, the MAGA mobs hounding local officials. And so they deploy violence. And while they talk about the language of liberty, they want to ban books and abortion and many voters and trans and marriage equality. So it's Social Security, and they talk liberty, but they really are for violence and lawlessness. And third, democracy. Democracy Now. I think that's a good phrase. Amy, you've been doing this your whole life, Ralph and I as well. The issue is not merely they want to reduce voting, because that's the only way they can win, being a minority party with bad ideas. Connect democracy and economy. Bob Kuttner, an economic writer, in his American Prospect and now in Our Volume, explains, you know, if you reduce the number of minority voters, then can the majority win when it comes to, gee, why don't we have secure Social Security? Why don't we have a higher minimum wage? Why don't we have a more child tax credits, which halves poverty among children? So if you focus voters on three issues where the Republicans are blocking progress and are engaged in violent acts and are undermining democracy, well, extremism is not patriotism. And they have to mobilize all these issues that Ralph listed in ways that the public, the swing public, those who pay little attention to campaigns until now, to get them to turn out and vote.
Ralph, let me ask Ralph about the role of the media in this campaign, your assessment.
Well, you know, if you talk about the main newspapers, the New York Times, Washington Post, et cetera, they're giving huge play to these crazed right-wing groups that nobody ever heard of. They put them on page one. They make them into a big act. And these groups love it. They use it for fundraising. Whoever heard of the Claremont Institute, for example? They give huge publicity to J.D. Vance. Why take a chance with Vance? He's a flip-flopper. He's a zigzagger. But the only recently gave attention to Tim Ryan, his opponent for the U.S. Senate in Ohio. They're constantly publicizing the right-wing people and groups and giving the impression there's nothing going on the progressive side, that there isn't voter registration drives by citizen groups and student groups on campuses. This is very damaging because they're giving publicity to the very groups and political forces, the GOP, the authoritarian, dictatorial, corporatist GOP, that's going to go after freedom of press, not just criticize them the way Trump does. They're going after freedom of press. So it's extremely short-sighted. WinningAmerica.net should be page one in the New York Times and Washington Post and not be ignored. It's 24 groups all over the country who know what they're talking about, and they're not getting any coverage. This is really the first national program on WinningAmerica.net. People, it's 80 pages long, chock full of ways to landslide this Republican Party. Imagine what FDR and Truman and Lyndon Johnson would have done to this GOP. Instead, they're slightly ahead in some of the polls in the congressional races. And their positions are routinely against workers, all workers. They don't want workplace safety rules enforced. They don't want worker pensions protected from corporate looting. They don't want workers to have a living wage. They don't want all workers to have health insurance. Why are workers voting for them? It's the default of the Democratic Party. This party doesn't know how to win. And
Ralph,
you're the only ones standing, defending our republic. So we're going to show you how to win.
Do you think President Biden should run again, Ralph?
Now you're getting into the presidential races here. It's far too speculative to say one way or another. I don't believe he would be too old to run. But we need a whole new generation of political and civic leaders who understand what the Constitution's all about, how to end empire, how to put corporations as our servants, not our masters, and how to develop access to justice and fight corporate judges. Biden's done a good job on trying to fight corporate judges in the nominations that he's put to the U.S. Senate.
Ralph Nader, you are 88 years old. You've campaigned as an independent and a green throughout your political life. You ran for president four times. Why now throw in your lot with the Democrats?
Well, this is clearly the most dangerous political movement since the Civil War. The GOP is under the corporate fascist Trump's thumb. He's bred a whole breed of mini-Trumpsters who are getting far too much publicity compared to their opponents. And everything we fought for, Amy, for over 50 years is at stake here. They're ready to do everything but tear seatbelts out of cars. They want to let Wall Street lie, cheat, and steal with impunity. They want to make sure the corporate crime wave continues to roll across America against workers and consumers and the elderly and children. So this is an order of magnitude we've never seen before. We've never seen a party so deliberately trying to repress the vote.
We have 10 seconds.
Pardon?
We have 10 seconds.
Yeah, we've never seen a party literally trying to repress the vote, miscount the vote, purge the vote, intimidate precinct worker volunteers, and steal elections. They've actually basically said any election we lose is because it's been stolen from us. That's the word of a dictatorship. Pardon.
We have to leave it there, Ralph. We want to thank you so much for being with us, legendary consumer advocate, and Mark Green, political organizer and activist. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe.
All right, yo, what up? It's Tester Man from Tester Logic. You're listening to my favorite radio station, CKUT, 90.3 FM in Montreal.
Are you a tenant in Montreal? Do you have questions about your rights? Your local housing committee can help. To find the housing committee for your neighborhood or for more resources, go to www.rclalq.qc.ca.
Cœur à cœur avec toi, CKUT 90,3 FM. CKUT, heart to heart with you.
Following is a previously broadcast program.
Amalo asing ini inuktitu ingi ko sila abining ini. Nala tu nagsi. I am Emily Sapa. Today is September 28, 2000.